everybody. It's Dr. Amy Myers. I'd like to welcome you to the next episode of the Myers Way podcast. Today, we have a fabulous guest, Dr. Kara Fitzgerald. Dr. Kara Fitzgerald is a naturopathic physician who got her doctorate in naturopathic medicine from the National College of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon. She's actually one of the faculty members at the Institute of Functional Medicine, and she lectures all over the world on the topic of allergic disease. So I'm really excited to have her here today to talk all about allergies, asthma, eczema, and the like. And I will say on a personal level, Kara and I have become friends over the last year or two. And how I met her, actually, when I first started out in functional medicine, she was working for the Metametrics, which is one of the lab companies that many of us use in functional medicine. And in the beginning, I didn't know much. And so I would call up and ask to speak to one of the doctors advising over at Metametrics. And I was always so excited whenever I would get Kara because she is so knowledgeable about a variety of topics. And then now here we are friends, and now she's on the podcast, and she's just really awesome and lots of valuable information. And I'm excited to welcome you, Kara.
Oh, thanks, Amy. That's so sweet. And it's been, likewise, it's really been nice to watch you bloom and, you know, bring your knowledge forth and your passion and your outreach to people. It's just really, really great to see. So, yeah, I'm thrilled to be here to talk about allergies. I think it's an important topic.
Yeah, well, we're super excited. I always like to start the podcast off by just allowing you a chance to introduce yourself in your own words of how you personally got into natural medicine and functional medicine, and then kind of what your role is as a faculty advisor and speaking all over the world on this topic.
Wow. Okay. Well, my story is, my story is interesting in that I grew up in a multi-generational family, like interested in all things natural. At least some key figures in my life were. My grandmother was an Adele Davis fan and really into organic gardening and shunned some of the early practices. She just intuitively knew they were wrong. Like, for instance, back in the day, the shoe stores would x-ray your feet. You know, when my mom was going for shoes as a little girl, they'd want to x-ray her feet. And my grandmother got that this couldn't be right. And so she would say, absolutely not. You know, and she just raised the kids with a really nice, healthy, organic diet. And of course, organic wasn't a word back then. It was just a garden,
Right.
it's really interesting. And then my mom carried that tradition on and raised us being mindful of eating food that we grew. And she used to, in fact, I used to be so excited when packages come, like kids are. And more often than not, it was her organic food shipments, which I just found to be a total tragedy. It wasn't a package for me. It was like, it was like some brewer's yeast vitamin. She was really into giving us brewer's yeast when I was a kid, or some sort of a whole organic grain that she would be getting. But as a kid, I wanted to be eating Twinkies like my friends, and I wasn't. But, now as an adult, I have such gratitude for how mindful she was and still is. Mm-hmm. Just really, really a deep level of gratitude for my mom and for my grandmother. My story is, I think it's kind of similar. I share it with a lot of other integrative doctors. I wanted to go to do doctorate level work. I wanted to go into either get an M. I knew I wanted to do something in medicine, get a doctorate in something. And I as I was going through that inner process of what do I want to do, who am I, what am I, asking those big questions, I became really sick with a fatigue. Started off with swollen lymph nodes and a low grade chronic fever, and after a period, I couldn't get out of bed. And I started the rounds with all the physicians, and nobody knew what it was. It's so typical. It's funny, Amy, because you asked me if I wanted to share the story, and I said, no, it's boring. Because what happened with me is just such a typical experience. So I made the rounds, and everybody just said, it's not real. Mm-hmm. they didn't, you know, they weren't with me when I would spike a fever, and you know, the swollen glands were minor enough where it wasn't a big deal. And so I was sent on and on and on. I do remember once a guy in urgent care giving me a prescription for B vitamins. Like, that was the most savvy response I got.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool, right? I mean, it's nice that he actually even thought that, you know, he was thinking about stress, and certainly stress was a factor. It wasn't the whole story. So, you know, down the line, eventually I met someone who was working with a naturopathic physician, and she said, why don't you go see him? And I did. And so he talked to me about Epstein-Barr and, you know, some of the other possible viral infections. And he just put me on a really nice protocol of botanicals and nutrients, talked to me about, you know, smart diet, kind of brought me back home a little bit, you know, to the things I knew growing up. And that was it. You know, it was the end of the issue.
Yeah.
And I really haven't experienced that degree of fatigue ever again. Although if I do get too stressed out, you know, I'll hit a wall and have almost like a viral kind of infection, kind of exhaustion. So I learned my limits, and that's part of our work, right? To just teach the patient to know themselves. And in my process of working with Dr. Class, his name is Dr. Jeffrey Class, and he's here in Connecticut, I learned what I needed to do to take care of myself and what the telltale signs are when I need to slow down, because I think I reactivate that, you know, that infection when I push it too far.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
And tell us about, because honestly, you guys have no idea on this podcast how lucky you're going to be to really hear from Kara, because this is what she teaches, this part of the module for the Institute of Functional Medicine. So all the physicians going through the training with the Institute of Functional Medicine are being taught by Kara. And then here we have her today to kind of give us a mini lecture conversation on this topic of allergy, you know, for all of you all to hear and understand. So tell us really about, you know, all your accolades in terms of the Institute of Functional Medicine, and you've a contributing author to a couple of books. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, you're so funny. Well, the easiest way to get all you've ever wanted to know about what I've been up to is to just go to my website, which is drkarafitzgerald.com. And you can see some of my backstory, but you can also read my blog. I publish a monthly blog on a variety of topics, and I am the co-author and editor of Case Studies in Integrative and Functional Medicine, and you can access that book. It's a book written for professionals, for physicians, but it's actually written in a way that's, you know, really pretty reasonably accessible. So if you're interested in that level of drill down, you might find the book interesting. And you can download two cases. So you can actually just go onto the website and you'll see that there are two PDFs for a case in rheumatoid arthritis and then a case study in ulcerative colitis. So you can get a sense of whether or not the book would interest you. So allergic disease. Yeah, my focus at the IFM, and indeed a topic that I spend a lot of time lecturing on in a variety of venues and, of course, working on in my practice, is allergic disease. And it's because it's just so ubiquitous. I have enjoyed the process of, you know, codifying, like putting down what it is I'm doing in practice that's successful with these patients. I see, you know, a large percentage of my practice are individuals with either a primary complaint that's allergic in nature or secondary complaint, some kind of secondary allergy.
Cool.
In other words, they come to me either with, you know, allergies as their main issue, or they come to me with something else like rheumatoid arthritis or whatever, but they also have some evidence of allergic disease. So it's, really the majority of my patients fall into one or two of those categories. So I've spent the bulk of my time in practice, you know, thinking about allergic disease and how we need to address it, and, you know, what the state of the research is, and, you know, just lecturing on it, it keeps me, pushes me to really be current in all things allergic. So I do my best to do that. But I know we'll have a mutual dialogue today, and I'm sure that I'll learn much from you as well, Amy.
Well, and the other part is Kara and I are part of a journal club that meets every month, and Kara sort of put that together, which is awesome. So I always feel privileged to be a part of people that are much smarter than me. So patients can get a hold of your website just because your spelling might be a little unusual. It's just Dr. and then Kara, K-A-R-A, and then Fitzgerald, G-E-R-A-L-D. And then we'll have a link to that as well.
All right. Thanks, Amy.
Yeah,
thanks.
Absolutely. Well, so let's just kind of get started with the basics. What are allergies?
What are allergies? Yeah, everybody has them. If you don't have them yourself in any really clear-cut way, you certainly know somebody who does. So it's an immune system disorder. It's a hypersensitivity disorder. So your system is overreacting to what is, you know, oftentimes something really harmless in the environment. So we're having mounting a hyperreaction to some pollen or some dust or cat dander or strawberries, you know, or peanuts. I mean, it's really kind of peculiar. We can have actually life-threatening reactions, immunological reactions, hyper responses to these otherwise benign substances.
And I mean, it seems like it's everywhere. I mean, you and I mm-hmm. kind of grew up around the same time, and this whole idea of, you know, when I was a kid and going to school, there was no peanut allergy. There was no, you know, separating the kids and the wheat people over here and the dairy people over there. I mean,
yeah.
What in the world is going on that the world has gotten this way and that kids, you know, can't even bring a peanut butter sandwich to school anymore?
Right. That's a really good point. So if you think about sort of like the garbage can of stress, I guess, that's getting filled up as our world becomes sort of more and more imbalanced, more medications, more antibiotics, more toxins, etc., less time outside and so forth. So, you know, we're increasing the incidence of allergic disease by leaps and bounds. But I want to just go back because allergies are really relatively recent phenomena. So even though they continue to rise, the fact of the matter is they weren't even around in the early 1800s.
Hmm.
Specifically, this piece of evidence is out of Europe. Hay fever wasn't happening there at all. And then the first case was reported in the middle 1800s, and then by the end of that century, it was epidemic. I mean, that's crazy in the onset. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and what is that? I mean, I know that there's several theories out there, right? The germ theory, the, you know, antibiotics. I mean, it's just.
And this predates antibiotics, so it's kind of interesting. It's a little interesting, little bit of a wrinkle. And we're going to talk about all of the things filling that, you know, that garbage can that I just mentioned. So this is one big variable. And the reason hay fever took off like a rocket was because of urbanization. So petroleum derivative pollution, the little particulates in the coal and, you know, and the various forms of petroleum being used as fuel and for light and all of this stuff. And so that's what's really thought to be the initial trigger of this hay fever. So what happened, this is so fascinating, those particles in and of themselves are irritants and can cause an allergic reaction, but they can also sort of prime the system, sort of like make the system just hyper alert, and then the system will start to react to other stuff. So, you know, hay fever is a reaction to, you know, environmental things like pollens and, you know, seasonal compounds most often. So they get the system all primed up with this toxin exposure. And then, you know, I guess they went out to the country, these 1800s Brits, and started reacting to the pollen out there. It's really kind of, it's very interesting to see. But the bottom line was that they just cranked up their immune system and got it on hyper alert. And that's a piece of the puzzle. And I also want to say, incidentally, because this is really another interesting factoid, is that anaphylaxis, you know, I'm sure you saw this when you were in the emergency department.
Yeah.
But, you know, the life-threatening reaction to a benign substance like peanut allergy, anaphylaxis wasn't even characterized in the medical literature until the 20th century.
Wow.
I know.
That's incredible.
I know. Isn't it absolutely incredible? And I think that there are sort of some vague reports of it before that, but really it's a modern phenomena, and those were some of the initial insults. But then so we have these factors that are biasing the immune system, and then, as you just alluded to, we add to it this, you know, the invention of antibiotics. Of course, they were incredibly wonderful and life-saving. I mean, back at that time, in the early 20th century, we died primarily from infectious diseases. So clearly having antibiotics was a godsend. No question about it. But, you know, unbeknownst to us, these antibiotics were killing off our gut bugs. And I know you've had podcasts talking about the microbiome, and you spend a lot of time talking about this. So I'm assuming that your listeners have heard of this, you know, large, wonderful sort of organ unto itself sitting inside our gut of microbes, really intricately involved in regulating our immune system. So when we start to introduce these antibiotics, and incidentally, vaccinations doing a similar thing, they sort of dampened and imbalanced our immune system in one direction, which allowed the allergic branch of the immune system, if you will, to be even more hyper alert. So allergies were, you know, the volume on allergies was turning up higher and higher with the introduction of these of antibiotics and vaccines.
Wow.
Now, and one of the interesting things is when you look into the research to really look at, okay, so there's enough developing countries out there that aren't used, you know, that still do have more active infections than we do. And, you know, maybe they don't have the same vaccine exposure as we do. And indeed, it bears out. You see that they don't have the same kind of allergic disease. And when those countries start to develop, like I just got back from lecturing on functional medicine in India, and India is just catapulting towards, you know, being fully middle class. And, you know, let me tell you, they're hitting allergic disease right and left. And you especially see it in the urban setting. You don't see it to the same extent out in the rural areas. So it's a real, it's an urbanization, it's a modernization phenomena, tweaking the immune system and imbalancing it. And then we start to really react to things that, you know, that we shouldn't react to.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm thinking back about it, I mean, when I was in the Peace Corps out in rural Paraguay, there was, you know, nobody sneezing or itching, or never saw eczema or any sort of, you know, skin disorder.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I know. You sure didn't, right? Yeah,
yeah,
you didn't have to be introducing inhalers, I'm sure, when you were in Paraguay.
Yeah, nobody.
Right,
absolutely.
So let me tell you, let me just color that in a little bit, because it's so interesting to me, and I'm hoping it is to you and to your audience as well. So the reason we actually developed this incredibly powerful arm of the immune system, it's called the Th1 arm, or the IgE arm. You know, the reason we developed this, which now spends most of its time reacting to benign stimulus, is because it was the arm of our immune system that fought the good fight with parasites. And it's interesting because parasites, you know, the definition is that, you know, a parasite's going to come in and take, you know, and ultimately destroy, right? The actual definition. It doesn't try to live with the host. It basically wants to tear the host down and break it open. But in reality, this arm of the immune system really had a negotiation process with the parasite, and the parasite actually helped balance out the allergic arm of the immune system. It helped calm it down and balance it with the other arms of the immune system, parasitic infections. And not just the little one, but, you know, these more protracted large infections we still see in certain countries, you know, that are a little bit less developed. And of course, you know, now, even in research settings and some, you know, more academic clinical settings, they're in reintroducing parasite infections that are parasites that are not as damaging, to help control certain kinds of conditions, one of them being allergic disease. So they're actually using parasites now as medicine in some cases. But that's a, you know, that's a whole nother conversation. But the reason I wanted to bring it up is that the compound, so what we understand now is that the a couple of reasons I want to bring it up. One, because parasites can be so aggressive and cause so much damage, we needed a very potent immune reaction. So you can see, like, the immune reaction, say, in an anaphylactic reaction is extremely powerful. You know, we had these very powerful tools to negotiate life with parasites. But the part of the parasite that we actually react to is, interestingly enough, kind of similar to the part that we react to in a pollen or the part that we react to in peanut. Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting. Why don't we even back up? Because I think, you know, I talk about this all the time in my clinic, but there may certainly be listeners out there that don't even really understand the components of the immune system, particularly when we talk about allergies, like, you know, the difference between an allergy and a sensitivity and the IgE versus IgG. So do you want to kind of just...
Sure. Yeah, sure. So allergy is mediated by what I'm calling the Th2 arm or the T helper cell 2 arm of the immune system. And involved in that is the classic immunoglobulin IgE or immune compound IgE. And it's, you know, we learn in school, I guess our mnemonic is IgE for emergency. You know, it's something that's sudden onset, can be as severe as life-threatening. But, you know when you have an allergic reaction, oh my goodness, you know, I have hives. I just ate soy and I've got hives. Or I just went outside into the spring weather and my nose is totally running. Or I've walked into a room full of dust mites and, you know, I've got a migraine headache or whatever it is. It's an immediate reaction. Whereas an IgG sensitivity, and we talk about IgG sensitivities most often in relation to food reactions, IgG is certainly involved in microbial, you know, mounting immune reactions to microbes and, you know, microbes primarily, but we can also mount a delayed hypersensitivity response that's mediated by IgG, immunoglobulin G. And that tends to happen in any length of, you know, from 4 hours on to 72 hours. I mean, it can be quite delayed that we have, we mount an IgG reaction to a food. Yeah. So yeah, when you're thinking about allergies, you're thinking about a pretty immediate response. There's one exception that I'll talk about later, but for the most part, think E emergency. And IgE, as I said to you, is this gatekeeper immune compound, very, very powerful, and it helps define self and non-self. And it was originally evolved to kind of, you know, deal with life with parasite infections. And if you look at where IgG is in the body, IgE is in the body, it's exactly where we mount immune reaction, classic allergic reactions. So it's on the skin, you know, where we'll have hives. It's in the, in the mucosa, in the lung tissue, you know, where we'll have asthma. It's in the nasopharynx, you know, the nose, where we can have our hay fever reaction in the sinuses, and then it's also in the gastrointestinal tract, and we can experience allergies in the form of really bad stomach pain and stuff like that. So that's where it resides, and that's why we see those kinds of reactions. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And let's talk about the gut and how important that is in, you know, all of this in terms of allergic disease.
Good. You're just kind of reeling me back into where we were when you brought up antibiotics and all of that. So, you know, I'm sure that the people that listen to your podcast know that the gastrointestinal area associated lymphoid tissue is, you know, just a major, major player when it comes to our immune system. It's, you know, the whole mucosa associated lymphoid tissue. Basically the immune system that wraps around the entire length of our gut from, you know, mouth to anus. I mean, that's just a big giant piece of immune tissue that's, you know, most of it, the bulk of it's hanging out there. So that means when we mess it with our guts, we're messing with our immune system. And allergy is no exception. So when we did introduce these antibiotics, and then later on non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, proton pump inhibitors, H2 blockers, I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. You know, when we introduced all these medications to our bodies, you know, it wasn't without ramification. And oftentimes that ramification is increased allergic disease. So if we damage the gut, if we compromise the gut, you know, we do often see a rise in allergies. In fact, you know, another interesting piece of research was done looking at blocking stomach acid using proton pump inhibitors, and they're one of the top prescribed medications in the country. I mean, they're really way up there, just billions of dollars a year.
And then think of all the ones over the counter, you know, all that aren't even needing to be prescribed.
Yeah, it's incredible. I won't get on my soapbox around it. But anyway, when they looked at blocking stomach acid, so they gave people either proton pump inhibitors or H2 blockers that shut off acid, they increased the incidence of food allergies over tenfold, greater than tenfold, 10 times more
wow.
likely. Is that, it's nuts. By turning off stomach acid.
And do you think that's from leaky gut? Do you think that that's from candida overgrowth? I mean, I personally see such a huge correlation, and be curious to hear from you, with candida overgrowth and things like asthma and seasonal allergies and eczema. I mean, when I hear any one of those three things, I'm pretty sure that the person has candida. And, that's usually because these people have also either had steroids or mm-hmm. antibiotics mm-hmm. as part of their course of treatment for any one of these things.
You're right on it, Amy. The fact of the matter is you need some level of what we call dysbiosis. You need some kind of dysregulation to the microbiome that hangs out in our gut, that's on our skin, you know, that's in our lungs. It's, you know, just this ubiquitous regulatory microbial mass. If you damage it, you can allow imbalances to overgrow. So, for example, if you shut off stomach acid, stomach acid breaks down a lot of it's the first line immune defense. It breaks down a lot of the bugs that are going to be coming through that we're exposed to all the time. So if you set stomach acid off, you know, you can allow dysbiosis to happen. And once the dysbiosis happens, once there's this initial immune imbalance / suppression, then yeah, candida can proliferate, and you know, other dysbiotic bugs, other damaging players also have an opportunity to grow over. And in addition, you lose your really, really important, helpful immune balancing flora, like bifidobacteria or lactobacillus. I'm sure your folks have heard of them. You know, those two players, they're in yogurt and kefir and that kind of thing, and you can buy them in supplements and so forth. Yeah, so you just imbalance the whole ecosystem, and certainly candida is one of the things that can overgrow. Yeah, when you culture out the skin, if you take a specimen of the skin of somebody with eczema and you grow it out, you'll always see some evidence of, you know, a fungus, more often than not, for sure.
Yeah, and what about what I've been seeing a lot recently in my clinic is histamine. How does histamine play a role in all of this?
Well, histamine is one of the classic allergic mediators, one of the classic allergic immunocompounds, if you will. You know, so histamine creates the itch. You know, histamine is itchy. Histamine generates the typical allergic reaction in the body. Histamine contributes to what you just mentioned earlier, leaky gut. You know, or you can look at the person with eczema as having leaky skin. Uh-huh. So, yeah, histamine mediates that for sure. Absolutely. And you know what? I want to also add to the picture that it takes, in order to develop the allergic reaction, it does take these initial imbalances that we're talking about. So there has to be some level of dysbiosis, you know, microbial imbalance, and this leaky gut concept. In order to become sensitized to one of these compounds, a pollen, a peanut, whatever, you have to have permeability, membrane excess permeability, and that initiates the sensitization process. And then once you release all those immune compounds in relation to that initial sensitization process, those immune compounds turn around and damage the gut, damage the skin, you know, damage the various mucosal membranes more, and then more compounds are allowed in and there's more of a reaction. It's very much a cyclical process until well, the season ends and then you'd kind of dampen, or you see an integrative doctor who starts balancing you out and giving you the immune balancing nutrients and pulling out the problem reactants and so forth.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this. I don't know if you've used that lab, the Dunwoody Labs. Have you started?
Yeah.
Have you?
Do you absolutely. Yeah, my residency director, Cheryl Burdett, is their chief medical officer. She's a really good friend of mine. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Because David told me about it at a conference.
David's good friends with them.
So David told me about it at a conference, and I came home and did it on myself. And I never thought of myself as a high histamine person. I mean, I'm not. I don't have the sort of triad allergy, eczema, asthma in my family, and I'm never, like, I don't get seasonal allergies. I just never even considered myself an allergic person whatsoever.
Was your histamine high?
Oh my gosh. Well, I was having these headaches, random headaches, like two or three times a week. And I couldn't figure it out. If it was, you know, the dog, if it was I didn't know what it was, something in the office, a stressful day. I mean, I'm making up all these stories and it's so funny. Here I am doing all this every day, but I couldn't figure it out of myself. So I did this test. My histamine was off the charts, and then my histidyl, the enzyme, was so low. And then, of course, I did the food sensitivity with the complement added to it, and, you know, it was a lot of the things I was, you know, bacon, and being on a paleo diet, it was bacon and avocados and coconut. Almonds, all this stuff that I was eating, like, you know, being gluten and dairy and whatever free wasn't bad enough. But anyway, I got off those foods, and I started taking the enzyme, and literally overnight, my headaches disappeared. I mean, to the point that it was like crack. I was like, I'm not eating a thing or putting it in my mouth without taking this enzyme.
Yeah.
And then I've had I've just started using it in my practice, like these amazing success stories. I had another child who I told I would mention on the podcast. They were in my office yesterday, just unrelenting eczema. I mean, really just every inch of his body, it just not touching it. And he walks in, I'm thinking, oh, it's gluten, dairy, and candida. You know, this is like my typical approach to eczema, no problem. In a month, he'll be good to go, you know? And this mother was, I mean, to the T with the diet, restrictive. He was six. He's amazing on the diet. I mean, just this family that has really poured everything into it. And, you know, 2-3 months later, nothing has budged. And they're just at their wits' end. So I'm like, you've got to do this test. I just did it on myself. It's amazing. And we also did an organics and got him on some, you know, essential fatty acids and various other things. And they came in yesterday, you know, so 2 months after doing that. And his stomach is, you know, smooth as butter. So just some amazing.
And well, here's the thing that's really interesting about what you're talking about, because that's a great, great story. But the histamine that you're speaking of, that you're needing to break down and that was high in you, is exogenous histamine. So it's histamine coming from some of the foods that you're eating.
Yeah.
And then you're not making enough of that enzyme in your gastrointestinal tract to break it down, and it becomes a systemic problem. So you and that child shared that underlying mechanism.
As well as small bowel bacterial overgrowth and leaky gut, which was the sort of take home of the whole thing, that it really is this cyclical thing. And then once you treat the small bowel bacterial overgrowth and you fix the gut, then, you know, I've already found, that in myself, that now I can eat meals without taking this enzyme and I don't get a headache. So I'm already seeing the end, you know, as I mentioned to the family, that will be the case, that over time they'll be able to, you know, stop this process.
Well, once you dampen it, you know, you're going to allow if it's not a genetic issue, like a frank genetic insufficiency of the DAO, your body will regenerate. You know, you'll be able to start to make some. I mean, you probably were just completely overwhelmed and it became insufficient. Or maybe you have a mild, you know, genetic issue with it. But yeah, regardless, that's a great story.
Well, it didn't help that I was, you know, drinking a smoothie every morning that was like strawberries and spinach and like all this really high histamine stuff that I didn't really realize, because I never thought of myself as an allergic person, so it didn't really cross my mind.
Well, and it's a little bit different. It's actually just, it's like a little, if you're going down that allergic road, maybe it's a slight bend to the right. I mean, it's a great, great, great idea because it's still histamine. It's histamine coming into the body from, you know, you find histamine in foods for sure, and you're not able to break it down. And yes, the headache is a really classic reaction. Eczema would also be a common reaction, but I think the quintessential reaction is a headache when you can't break down food histamine for sure. So that's great that you found it. And yes, it's a really nice lab that Cheryl's assay that Cheryl started to do over there. You know, the other piece of the puzzle, so that would be when you have refractory eczema. That's one thing to consider, the histamine that you've just elegantly outlined in your six-year-old. Sometimes, however, we have to address the outside. You know, we have to do an inside out and an outside in. So most of the majority of my eczema cases have responded by going inside out, as you're talking about. Treat the gut, pull the food reactions out, aid in digestion, et cetera, and then you clear the skin. But sometimes the skin is so damaged that you really have to focus on treating the skin as well. And you won't get good outcome until you address it, the so-called outside-in method. And that's because we have a number, particularly Europeans, have a high incidence, like up to 10% or more, a certain mutation. It's actually called filaggrin, and it's the protein associated with skin permeability, believe it or not. I mean, it keeps the skin, when you have a functioning filaggrin, when you have enough of this protein in your tissue, your skin's not leaky. When you have an insufficient amount of filaggrin, it can become very leaky, and you can see what we call ichthyosis vulgaris, which is very, very severe dry skin, or you can see eczema and, you know, dermatitis and all sorts of other fun things happening on the skin because of this mutation. And it's very, very common. So back in the day, before we had rampant dermatitis, the filaggrin, they hypothesized that the reason that so many of us have this filaggrin mutation, I actually am homozygous for it, and I tend to get a little bit of eczema. They think that one of the reasons we had it was that it allowed for a little bit of passive vaccination. You know, way back in the day, it would increase our immune response to certain organisms and we would develop a memory. So it was something that we selected for in evolution. Maybe that's one of the working theories. But now in this hygienic world, where our immune system is really revved up and ready to pounce, those of us with filaggrin mutations react to everything through our skin. Wow. So sometimes you'll find an eczema patient where you need to do that. And one of the telltale signs is hand eczema. So hand eczema, that's very highly associated with this particular mutation. And there's a host of more skin-specific protocols that need to happen to turn it around. But you can turn it around. You can certainly reduce it quite a bit. I mean, they have the mutation, so they have the vulnerability, so they're going to have to be a little bit mindful. But we have such powerful tools in our kit.
And what would some of those, what are things that you use for those cases?
Well, you're going to use all of the things that you've already mentioned that you did with the six-year-old. But then you need to think about a little bit more specifically about skin dysbiosis or bug imbalance. And one of the go-to things that I've found is a very, very, very small amount of bleach in either a hand soak if we're just dealing with hand dermatitis or in a tub. So literally, in a 40-gallon tub at the very end of the bath, adding like a half a cup of bleach and then hopping in and soaking for just a few minutes, you know, draining the tub, rinsing the bleach off really thoroughly in the shower, and then slathering the body with like a what I call a moisturizer sandwich. So you put a humectant moisturizer or a water-soluble moisturizer that's clean, doesn't have parabens or phthalates, as the base layer. And then on top of that, you can put what we call an occlusive moisturizer or something that's going to form a barrier. So you're putting moisture on the skin, and then you're blocking it in with the occlusive. And the occlusive needs to be something that's heavy and not going to melt off. Unfortunately, one of our best tools remains petroleum. But you could experiment, like you could do like a something that has a reasonable amount of beeswax and isn't going to just disappear, you know, so a beeswax shea combination, you know, that you could experiment with various various heavy moisturizers from the health food store and see what works for you. There was a product that I used to use called Unpetroleum that formed a reasonable barrier. But a lot of what we have kind of melts quickly and doesn't form a, you know, a longer lasting one. And then finally, the third arm of this is that you want to help to improve the barrier. Not just hold the moisturizer in and supply moisture, but you actually want to give the nutrients to the skin that it needs. And our one of our aces for this is something called a ceramide topical. So ceramides are the most abundant fatty acid in the skin. And in individuals with this filaggrin mutation, individuals with dermatitis really of any kind or ichthyosis have a deficit, a significant deficit of ceramide. And you can get ceramide topicals in a prescription.
What would that be?
It's called, well, the two that I use is called, one of them is Episerum.
Yeah, we tried that, yeah.
And the, well, you have to get it, there's, so I'm detecting that you tried that without success.
It wasn't until we really fixed the gut that things started happening. I mean, they were doing absolutely everything. So I don't know what, I mean, it finally the pendulum swung the other way, you know, while doing multiple things.
Ah, got it. So if he has an underlying inability to metabolize histamine.
Yeah.
Until you find that particular piece, you're going to, you can't go outside in and expect resolution unless... You have to just, you know, it's a case by case basis. And like I said, one of the clues for you is going to be if it's on his hands, if he had hand dermatitis. My guess is that he probably didn't have classic hand eczema. He might have, but he might be a heterozygous filaggrin person. I wouldn't be surprised if he was, but he probably wasn't a null filaggrin like some of our hand eczema folks are. I mean, they're dealing with massive skin permeability. So it's a different animal. You're shining the light. You're going to be doing a lot of the similar things, but the amount of weight, you know, as it were, for the particular interventions is going to shift depending on what the underlying causes are.
Right.
Okay.
And
does that make sense?
Yeah. And do you see with, I know it's a completely different mechanism, but, well, I mean, to some degree, with psoriasis with these creams?
Well, again, you have to do all the underlying
work. Of course,
without question. So in this particular, in a host of individuals that I've had, Episerum, using ceramides in whatever, you know, whatever prescription form.
Is there another one besides the Episerum?
Yeah, there's another product that I like called Hyalotopic. Hyalotopic, Hyalatopic. Hyalotopic is a combination of ceramide as well as hyaluronic acid. Okay. And I like that one as well. It's a piece of it. And it's particularly useful in that you can begin to titrate one off of their steroid dependence using these topicals. And they are shown to, in standard practices and, you know, in the data that these companies developed was they were working on their products and testing them. They did reduce the dependence on steroids. They showed in both psoriasis and in eczema. The problem is, though, just to talk about steroids, because steroids are ubiquitously used in allergic disease, and I'm not going to tell somebody not, you know, you have to really be careful when you're manipulating steroids in an allergic patient. You know, you can't just simply stop somebody's inhaler, until you do all of the underlying work. I mean, you have to do a slow titration off the steroid as you're doing the underlying work and as the symptoms are abating by treating the underlying cause. But I can tell you for sure that using steroids will perpetuate the disease because steroids melt the barrier. I mean, that's exactly what they do. They turn the immune system off, but concurrently, they actually melt the barrier.
Yeah, it's and a big catch 22.
Yep, and we definitely see rebound allergic disease in steroid-dependent people. But yeah. But it's a slow titration. And you especially see that in, you know, it's most obvious, I guess you could say, in people with eczema. So kind of a delicate balance, and we need all of our tools. We don't, interestingly though, you don't always have to do an aggressive outside in protocol until, unless you have one of these people that's not responsive. Like in the bulk of my practice, most of my skin patients respond when I do the inside work.
Yeah, let's kind of go. I mean, you know, yes, people have heard my podcast, and we know in functional medicine it all starts in the gut and changing the diet and that kind of stuff. But let's just, you know, somebody comes in to see you with allergies or eczema or asthma. Can you kind of just quickly walk us through kind of your step-by-step approach and maybe tell us some of your big, guns, you know, natural guns that you use in this process?
Mm.
Is that possible? I know that's
I'm going to give you.
$1,000 question.
I'll just give you a general walkthrough.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So yeah, you treat the gut. So you do a 5R. You know, you just do a standard 5R. You look for what's wrong. You know, what issues are present. What deficiencies are present. What foods are they reacting to? Do they need digestive support? Do they have sufficient stomach acid? What's their vitamin D? You know, you want to start them on fish oil. There's a host of natural antihistamine products out there. Vitamin C is wonderful. Quercetin, stinging nettles, bromelain, etc. There's combination products you can buy. You want to get them onto good probiotics that have been demonstrated to help balance the immune system, like Lactobacillus rhamnosus is a good example of one. Bifido, those guys have been shown to help balance. D and L lactate producing bacteria seem to inhibit some of the allergic interleukins. And they also help increase secretory IgA, which is the good anti-inflammatory immunoglobulin, whereas IgE causes the allergies. IgA helps to protect us from the allergies, so good probiotics will help increase those as well. Gut work. Now, you also have to, if you've got somebody coming in with sinusitis, chronic sinusitis, hay fever, etc., asthma, you need to start sleuthing as to what the source materials are. So I always do IgE environmental testing. You know, so are they reacting to dust mites? Are they reacting to dander? You know, what in their environment are they reacting to? And we do a big cleanup. You know, they need to, they have to have, if it's a dust mite person, they've obviously got to get good bedding. They might have to get the carpets out. In fact, oftentimes they do. They're going to have a nice HEPA air filtration system in the areas in their house that they spend the most time in. Sometimes I'll go further and have them test for molds in the home. I'll have them buy mold plates. You can just go to the Home Depot and grab some mold plates, stick them around the house. They'll tell you how to do it and see what grows out. I have a chronic sinusitis patient now who just has massive amounts of aspergillus just blooming all over, not just her home, but in her school.
Yeah, in fact, schools are some of the worst. I mean, it's really bad.
So until we remediate that, we're not going to be able to successfully treat through the amount of mold that's in our world right now.
Yeah, and just a quick comment on that, because, and I know, I don't think you've seen quite as much, or maybe you have, with the, you know, with the mycotoxins, which are the actual toxic molds, and those plates won't, now aspergillus can give off some toxic molds, but it doesn't actually test for the mycotoxins. So, and anybody that's curious about that can listen to my podcast on the mycotoxins. So just, if you come back with a, you know, clean plate, it doesn't mean that there can't be something, you know, still behind the wall that is, you know, not, wouldn't be picked up on that plate anyway, if that makes sense.
Right. So for me, I think that you're right. And I know we've had this conversation and you've really seen that a lot in Texas. I haven't had to go that far here in Connecticut. I tend to go for the low hanging fruit. and then, you know, dive more vertical as I need to. But I know that you see it a lot, and it's one of your first line checks, and it makes total sense to me. When I was in Atlanta, it was such a mold toxic place. And, you know, just in terms of your weather patterns in Texas, you guys are really similar. So I understand that you're seeing it there a lot. We used to see it all. We used to see so much, just people's particle board would just blossom with mold, like overnight, if there was a certain kind of a humidity outside.
Right.
Yeah, it was really something to say.
Yeah, I know. I'm definitely go for the low hanging fruit. I just don't want people to, you know, often when people listen to things or read articles, they try to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. And so just don't want somebody getting discouraged if something's negative. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's just like going to your doctor and getting tested for celiac or even a gluten allergy and, you know, those being negative, but then you feel bad when you eat it. You know, the proof is in the pudding. You feel sick in your home, but everything's coming back negative. Well, that's a sign that there is something in your home or your office or school or whatever is causing you a problem.
That's a huge flag. That's right. If you go into environment X and you react, there's something in environment X that you're reacting to.
Right.
And you will have to sleuth out what that is. And I think one can do some of these things on their own. There's no doubt. But if you've had this issue for a long time, and if it seems to be worsening or it hasn't been responsive to a handful of interventions, it's really a good idea to work with a doctor who's in the know with these treatments, because you need to put together a protocol that is dosed sufficiently. You know, if you get an over-the-counter fish oil, oftentimes it's just incredibly insufficient in the amount of active ingredient it's going to deliver. And you also want to make sure it's pure, but I'm all for doing self-intervention if you're up for it. But I know in some of these cases, it's just, you know, you need a guiding hand, someone to be with you to do the sleuthing and so forth.
Yeah. Okay. So looking at the gut, looking at the diet, looking at the environment, mm-hmm. and then any mm-hmm. kind of, you know, go-to kind of, I know you use, you know, herbal remedies a bit more than I do. I mean, we both use nutraceuticals, but any kind of go-tos that you can think of that you use frequently or?
Well, people, like I said, people are going to be on a decent probiotic.
Yeah.
Do you want me to tell you what brands I'm using?
Oh, it doesn't. It doesn't matter. I mean, I think probably most people can't get a hold of those unless they're seeing one of us. So, you know, up to you, whatever you want to do.
All right. Well, you want to get on a decent, good, broad-spectrum probiotic. I use Claire. Actually, I use Thorn Floramend a lot these days, you know, and, you know, you want to dose it sufficiently.
I use Claire, too.
Yeah, it's a nice
good one.
They make good products.
Yeah.
So you're going to be on a high dose fish oil is essential. And I use, right now, I've been using a lot of Designs for Health, Hypo. You know, it's a good product. I trust the purity. There's a lot of good products out there. And you have to dose it adequately. I would say you need to get up to at least 2 grams or more of the active ingredients, EPA and DHA, if you want to affect a change. And, you know, fish oil takes a while to work. It's not an overnight thing. You basically have to replace the cell membranes, you know, push out the arachidonic acid, replace the arachidonic acid content in the membranes and some of the saturate content in the membranes with the anti-inflammatory EPA and DHA. And that's not an overnight process. I mean, just think about the half-life of a red blood cell is, you know, 120 days. So that, you know, it's going to take in that department, but you can do that. And incidentally, arachidonic acid is a major pathogenic, the eicosanoids, the pro-inflammatory compounds derived from arachidonic acid, the pro-inflammatory, our main pro-inflammatory fatty acid that we see high in everybody living the Western life and the Western diet. It's a huge player in allergic disease, and particularly asthma. Those compounds are the things that cause. Actually, it's a huge player in all allergic diseases, but they cause the bronchi to constrict. You know, they cause they're just fundamental metabolic pathogenic mechanisms in allergic disease. So, changing that, improving the diet, changing the ratio of fatty acids is huge. Also, there's an anti-inflammatory fatty acid called DGLA, and we get that in the diet from borage and from evening primrose. Or I should say we get it in the in supplements because we don't eat borage evening primrose oil.
I found that one really helpful, balancing that out and really doing, you know, if you're working with a practitioner, you know, an ion panel or something to really see the ratio of your omega-3s to omega-6s and see, because, you know, I found that one really helpful.
Yeah. And it has some pretty nice data behind it around allergic disease as well.
And go ahead. Yeah. No, I was just going to those all sound like awesome suggestions. And then just sort of thinking, my guess is in terms of preventing, you know, getting this, having allergies or eczema, is really kind of the same types of things as it is almost getting out of the situation, making sure your gut is okay and whatnot. But do you have any comments surrounding that, you know, preventing?
Well, geez, I would go back to preconception. You know, there's a very strong epigenetic component to allergic disease, epigenetic. So it's not quite the gene. We talked about the filaggrin mutation as being an issue in certain eczemas. But, you know, if our genetics are, let me just give you an example. If grandma is smoking while pregnant with mom, mom's reproductive cells are going to be biased towards allergic disease. And not only will mom be vulnerable to allergic disease, but because that smoke influenced mom's reproductive cells, mom's children are going to be vulnerable to increased allergic disease. So that smoke 3 generations ago is going to, you know, make the kids sick. So there's this whole epigenetic phenomena that we're just beginning to uncover. So preconception as a big piece, you know, making sure mom's balanced, making sure dad's balanced, that's huge. You know, what's interesting is that pregnancy is actually, this is going to sound a little weird, but pregnancy is actually a Th2 biased condition. So your body inhibits parts of the immune system that might damage the fetus. And so it ends up being a little bit more allergic vulnerable, if you will. So that pregnancy process could, you know, sets kids up unless, you know, mom's pretty balanced. So make sure mom's got enough omegas, you know, make sure mom's vitamin D is good. Make sure, you know, she's got good magnesium, B vitamins, you know, just make sure mom's balanced.
Probiotics.
Probiotics, of course. Yeah. Thank you. Well, you know, make sure she's not really super inflamed, but really give baby a super healthy environment to grow up in. And, you know, vaginal delivery, you want to avoid antibiotic exposure when pregnant, if at all possible. Clearly breastfeeding is going to be very helpful. And, you know, all of those things are big gun preventative pieces. And now once you're born and you're an adult and you want to you have kids and you want to help support your children from developing allergies if they don't have them or if they're only mild, then, you know, you really want to do the same handful of things. You know, good, make sure they're eating adequate fish, adequate fatty fish, or you're giving them an omega-3 fatty acid. Make sure you're, you know, they're on some kind of a probiotic. Make sure they get outside. You know, make sure your kids are exposed to life and not sitting inside watching TV. You are not going to have a robust microbiome if you're not if you don't challenge the immune system by touching dirt and playing in the creek and so on and so forth.
As I'm, when I get my kale and veggies from Whole Foods, you know, I just put them in the basket and, you know, everybody else is putting it in the bag and then I just throw it on the conveyor belt.
I know.
And, you know, they're like, do you want this or that? I'm like, no, I just let it soak up everything. It's better for my immune system. I don't wash any of my vegetables or anything. So, but yeah, and then avoiding those things like Purell and hand sanitizers and antibiotic soaps all that stuff that, you know, everybody's there like, oh my God, it's my baby. I'm changing the diaper. Get the Purell out and, you know, wipe them down with the sanitizer. And before you eat, don't touch that. Come over here and do this. So all that stuff, guys, is actually really bad for you. Let them put their fingers in their mouth. It's going to build good immunity.
You know, even the CDC is coming out with that. There was a CDC guy just interviewed not too long ago, actually speaking specifically about the hand sanitizers and so forth and the potential to introduce antibiotic resistance. Yeah, we're just, you know, we're in full-on overkill mode. You know, we forget that we just have these fabulous immune systems and, you know, they need to be supported, not suppressed.
Right. Well, how about before we wrap it up here, any, you know, a success story or success stories that really come to mind that you want to tell us about?
Sure. So just really quickly, the hand dermatitis patient who incidentally came to me originally for polymyalgia rheumatica, which is an incredibly painful it's sort of autoimmune. It's a really significant inflammatory disorder that impacts your muscles and so forth and your joints, and oh, it's horrible. Anyway, we cleared that out actually relatively quickly by pulling her off problem foods and treating her gut and so on and so forth. But it was those hands that were really challenging for us. And so just doing the ceramides, you know, introducing a very minute amount of bleach to deal with this topical dysbiosis, and getting a good sandwich of moisturizers on her, and what else? I even had her try topical probiotics. I think that eventually we'll see a whole class of topical probiotics come out that are really useful.
It up yourself?
Yeah, I told her to mix it up. I said, look, take some of your Claire, and you know, be a little bit mindful if you've got a really outrageously open lesion. You know, maybe you don't want to throw it in there. My guess is that you'll probably be fine. But anyway, we did
so you
these
just
things.
Put it in your her lotion, and then add it in a little bit of.
Yep. Exactly. That's
awesome.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, I would have her seal her hands up at night with something like, I remember back in the day, you know, people would use plastic wrap, but, you know, something less, something less toxic if possible, you know, just to keep it all in there and just kind of create a nice warm environment and let everything kind of, you know, enter into the dermis and the deeper tissue and dampen the immune response. And she incidentally had what we call trichinichia or 20-nail dystrophy. All of her fingernails were incredibly mangled, basically, because of this really severe, it was part of the eczema problem. She had eczema fingernails. Everything eventually cleared, and she's fabulous. She's just doing great now. There's also a condition that's on the rise significantly. We see it in kids, and it's called eosinophilic esophagitis. We'll see it in adults too, but it's a pediatric issue, I think, a little bit more so right now. But and because it's actually the reason we see it a little bit more in peds is because it's so closely associated with classic food allergies, and that can either present with an experience of really intense reflux. And if the child's too young, they're obviously not going to be able to say that what they're experiencing is reflux, but they're going to be in pain. And they might say that their stomach hurts. But there's also eosinophilic gastroenteritis. So there's a condition that can happen in the stomach and the small intestine. And then there's a type that can happen in the esophagus, and it's an accumulation of eosinophils, which are, you know, cells also involved in that like allergic bias picture. And they hang out in the gut and they just wreak havoc, or hang out in the esophagus and wreak havoc. And they're completely associated. This phenomena is completely associated with classic food allergies, not food delayed sensitivities, not celiac, food allergies, allergic, you know, and top allergies are wheat, dairy, shellfish, nuts, soy, corn. Those are the big guys. So you need to figure out what the individual is reacting to. And remember, again, they're going to have dysbiosis and they're going to have gut permeability, and they're probably going to have nutrient insufficiencies that help regulate the immune system, like vitamin D. Vitamin D deficiency is associated not only with dysbiosis, but also with leaky gut. And vitamin D deficiency is thought to be one of the underlying pathogenic factors in allergic disease. So you need to make sure their nutrients are dialed in, you know, you treat the leaky gut, you know, pull out the reactive foods and so forth. So I had a classic eosinophilic, I've had a few of them, but eosinophilic esophagitis case, and she just wasn't getting help in the conventional arena. And she was really straightforward. I mean, this girl hadn't been to school in weeks and weeks because the pain was absolutely unbearable. The poor thing. And, you know, we needed to do very basic gut work, pull out the problem foods, put the good stuff back in, you know, and she was on her way.
How do you diagnose that?
With biopsy.
That's what I figured. Okay.
You have to have a certain amount of eosinophils present per high power field. That's how you diagnose it.
Yeah.
What else? You know, I had a really interesting a patient now who's got pruritus ani. He's got a really itchy butt, quite frankly. And it's been there for 40 years. Like really bad. When I had him give me his 1 to 10 ranking, he said that it was a 15 on a scale of 1 to 10. Yeah, it was horrible. And this guy had it for 40 years. He hadn't slept a full night because of this for 40 years. And he was a referral from our pain center, which I used to be a physician at the pain, you know, it's a tertiary care pain center. So this guy had been to every physician under the sun, you know, dermatitis, dermatologists, neurologists, psychiatrists, allergists, you know, on down over and over and over. And when they can't do anything, of course, you punt them over to the pain clinic and then you just give them whatever drugs you need so you don't even know you have an anus, let alone an itchy one.
Right.
But he wasn't getting any better. And so they ended up referring him to me. Send him to the naturopath.
Right.
when we don't know what to do. And honestly, he's got food allergies. I mean,
Did he have candida?
You know, not remarkably, not in any way that we needed to address like too aggressively, but really he had food allergies. A friend of ours, Todd, he's such a brilliant doctor and I love him. He's a brother from another mother, but he had said that it's pinworms, Kara, until ruled out. And of course, obviously, that's one of the first things we think of as physicians.
Absolutely.
But all of those standard differentials had been moved through with this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd been in the system for decades and decades. But nobody had looked at allergic disease. The interesting thing is that he did not present with any classic allergic picture. So it's just one of the pieces that we investigated. And when we, you know, and when we worked with him, he's better. You know, he's just getting on with his life and it's quite wonderful. And he's off his antihypertensive. He's off his prostate meds. He's off his, what else? He was on allopurinol. He had gout. You know, he's just doing fabulous. He's lost 30 pounds. Yeah. So
those all sound like awesome cases. I got one final question for you that I'm actually sort of curious about. I know my answer to it, but I'm curious. And my guess is the listeners out there will be as well. What is your thought on, both allergy shots as well as like those sublingual, allergy immune modulators? Any thoughts on those?
And
what is that really doing?
I think sublingual immunotherapy is an awesome idea. I use it all the time. I don't do, I don't use allergy shots, but I definitely use sublingual immunotherapy. In fact, the pruritus ani guy is on, sublingual immunotherapy. It just helps introduce tolerance, plain and simple.
An allergy shot?
I think that allergy shots are okay, but they're a drag. I mean, I personally wouldn't want to have to go to the allergist all the time. And I think that the nice things about sublinguals are you're introducing the antigens daily, you know, three times a day. And the research on them is very, very solid. You know, you're not going to the allergist and getting shot up.
I'm kind of surprised. I mean, I know you're building tolerance, but I thought that, you know, the way that I sort of, particularly if it's some sort of IgE, that it was really just then converting you over to an IgG. And, you know, why not fix the gut and heal the dam, and then you can tolerate whatever it is rather than modulating your immune system.
You can do that in a subset of people, possibly. You can do that in a subset of people, but you can't do that in everybody.
Yeah.
You know, sublingual immunotherapy is a really helpful tool in a lot of our patients, and it can expedite the process for some. It can give them quicker relief. So even if it does, so part of the mechanism is that when you begin to develop tolerance, what you can see on labs is a rise in IgG, because IgG4 specifically is a blocking antibody. But over time, that IgG4, you know, with an appropriate balancing of the immune system, should normalize.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Kara, Dr. Fitzgerald, this has been amazing. I really appreciate you being on today. You've just been a, you know, real wealth of information. And just for everybody, if they're interested in contacting you to be a patient or get your book, that's at drkarafitzgerald.com. And do you have a Facebook presence or anything else that you want to
include? I do, Dr. Kara. It's just the same thing. It's Dr. Kara Fitzgerald. I think my website is the better place to go. You're welcome to go to my Facebook if you want to, but the website has all the information that you could want and probably more.
Yeah, she has a great newsletter, and then the case studies book. I mean, I have a copy of that. It's really great, and I do think that particularly those of you out there that are listening to these podcasts and have some sense of, you know, of functional medicine, I don't feel like it's written in a way that would be too beyond you. So, and there are just a lot of varied cases of all different sorts, and really a stepwise approach of how Kara or other physicians, you know, helped these patients recover. So it's a really great resource if there are any physicians or practitioners listening, and even just people that are interested in learning more. So, Kara, any final words that you'd like to say?
Well, thanks for having me, Amy. It was fun.
Yeah.
It's always nice to dive into the world of allergies. Because there's so much we can do. It's just really, really, we have a fabulous toolkit with regard to working with allergic disease.
Well, you've been an awesome resource for me, you know, over the years. I mean, seriously, I just remember in the very beginning, every test that I would get, I would be calling and making appointments, and I very quickly, you know, could tell who, because I guess seemed to have a little bit more advanced line of questioning than the average new doctor starting out. And so I knew who could answer my questions and who couldn't. And I was always like, is Dr. Fitzgerald there today? You know, I always wanted you. Or Cass, as I said the other day on our with the Journal Club, I always knew you two were the ones that could like go to a different level and really dig down deep where I wanted to go with my questioning. So I definitely, you know, am very thankful for you, you know, as a friend and as a colleague, and very early on in my practice, honestly, you helped me tremendously. So thank you so much. And thank you for being on the podcast. And
you're welcome.
Yeah. All right.
All right. I'm sure we'll chat soon.
Absolutely.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at Amy Myers, MD.